The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you. Just before I walked out here, someone said, break a leg. But I did that already. So today I've decided I'm just going to stand on my two feet and tell you a little bit about the book. Then my favorite part of this is always hearing your questions, because that's when I get to learn a little bit more than I usually brought into the room. Thank you. I'm glad to be back in Philadelphia. I say back because my father was an AME minister who pastored a church at 16th and Jefferson for many, many years. And my mom was his wife, and my mother, and this is one of the things you need to know about my parents who have both passed on, is that my father was an accidental feminist. He raised his children to say, to do anything they wanted, but didn't bother to tell his daughters that they were an exception to the rule. He was actually a pretty awful sexist in many respects. But as many people can tell you, he didn't have the heart for it, really. So as a result, I dedicate this book to both my parents, who, as I say in the dedication, did not live to see the day. I have to tell you about how this book came together. People, as you can, you may have read a time or two that I was accused of writing a pro-Obama book and was hopelessly compromised by having written it, by having written this book. The critics didn't realize is that I've been carrying this book around in my head for years. That I had, and in reporter's parlance, we gather string. We gather little pieces of information and we add it together until we have a full story. And the truth is, I had been carrying little bits and pieces of the story about race and politics ever since I decided I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a reporter or a writer or something that involved deadlines very early. Yes, it's true to this day. Very early in my career, and it was fed from the curiosity of growing up in a home where my father and my mother made the direct connection between what was happening in the world and what was happening in our lives. It probably came from coming of age at a time when there was so much incredible conflict and movement in our society in the 60s and 70s that you could easily make that connection. And it also came from the fact that as you start to write and you start to move from city to city, as I did, and start to learn about new situations, you begin to see a lot of similarities. The beginning of the book, I write this. I learned how to cover race riots by telephone. They didn't pay me enough at my first newspaper job to venture into the streets, onto the grounds of South Boston High School when bricks were being thrown. Instead, I would telephone the headmaster and ask him to relay to me every day the number of broken chairs in the cafeteria, and then they would send a white colleague to the scene to fill in the details for me. I've spent 30 years in journalism since then chronicling stories just like that, places where truth and consequences collide, rub up against each other, and shift history's course, and none of that prepared me for 2008 and the astonishing rise of Barack Obama. It is true that he accomplished what no other black man had before, but it went further than that. Simply as an exercise in efficient politics, Obama 08 rewrote the textbook. His accomplishment was historic and one that transformed how race and politics intersect in our society. Obama is the leading edge of the change, but his success is merely the ripple in a pond that grows deeper every day. I wanted to write about the pond. I wanted to write about what was going to happen next, not just this one event. It occurred to me that there were a lot of people like that. And I don't say them a lot of Obamas because a lot of them preceded him. We had never heard the man's name till 6 years ago, you will recall. Actually, 6 years ago is generous. A lot of us had never heard the man's name till 2004. So along comes this man who gives a framework. His ambition gives a framework to a story that I've been seeing unfolding. When Boston, where I covered these race riots in the Boston School Committee and discovered that everything is politics, whether your kids get to go to school or not, whether you are able to feed your family or pay your mortgage is all sometimes controlled by people who are engaged in politics. I moved it to Baltimore, where the first black mayor was elected while I was living there, and I saw the city tipping from 50-50 white-black to 51-49, just enough to start getting black people elected state citywide. I covered the state house. I moved to Washington. I covered Prince George's County, which is a suburban county outside of Washington, D.C., which was also becoming majority black, but in a middle-class, prosperous, gated golf community kind of way. But as a result, other people were also taking control. And change never happens easily. You may have figured that out by now in the first month of the Obama administration. In fact, there's always friction. There's always conflict. And for these breakthrough candidates, it often happened in the form of black aspirants to political office taking jobs from other black office holders. Each of the people I profile in this book, both the four major people and everybody else, they got to their jobs by stepping up when nobody gave them permission to. They were often told, often by other African Americans, "Sonny, why don't you just sit over there? We'll get to you in a minute. Why don't you wait?" Somewhere along the way, people who seize power lose sight of one of the things that Martin Luther King Jr. knew in his letter from the Birmingham jail, that sometimes it costs too much to wait. So in order to break through, you had to be willing to say, "I want to do this. I want to be a little audacious about it." You have to be willing to lose, perhaps the first time out. Barack Obama got beaten by Bobby Rush. Cory Booker got beaten by Sharp James. After a while, you have to figure a way through that, if that's truly the public service you choose. And so along the way, there are all of these different things you stumble upon. One of the most interesting things I stumbled upon was the generational split. How it turned out that mothers and daughters and fathers and sons didn't necessarily see the world the same way as aspirations became law, as the world became shaped by access instead of denial. One of the power families in black American politics is, of course, the Jacksons of Chicago. And one of the things I did as my very first job at the Washington Post, covering national politics, was to cover, well, actually my job was to cover all the losing candidates in 1988. I was at the bottom of the totem pole, so whenever it looked like Paul Simon or Dick Gephardt or Bob Dole wasn't going to win, they'd send Gwen out there, and the candidate would look at me with, you know, doom in his eyes. He'd say, "Here she comes," with the wearing the hood, all that. But eventually, the only person left standing besides Michael Dukakis was Jesse Jackson. He wasn't going anywhere, it turns out, at least not until the convention. But covering him exposed me to an entirely different kind of political coverage, which is this guy could run a campaign on a shoestring. I ate a lot of fried chicken and macaroni and cheese and greens that year from church basements. He found a way to just show up in the most unlikely places around the country in the middle of the night and still get a crowd. But he was running a different kind of campaign, an old-fashioned civil rights kind of campaign. He was also relying heavily on African-American pride. As he went on, we forget that Jesse Jackson won 13 contests in 1988. So at some point, it wasn't just black votes he was winning anymore. He was stretching out. He was reaching beyond. But his son, who's now a member of Congress, sees the world slightly differently. I talked to him in his office at one point early in this reporting process. And he's one of five children. He calls it the continuum of black politics. It's something he's been giving a lot of thought to. It's something his father speaks about as well. But while the father thinks back to the arc of a movement that started in the 1950s or before, the son is more focused on saving black folk from the sins of their fathers. Jesse Jr. said to me, "There is a movement in the black community toward accountable leadership. The paradigm for the unaccountable leaders has radically shifted. I consider very respectfully," he said, "and this is for the record," he said, "my father to be a part of the unaccountable leadership, even though I completely believe in and trust his mission and his motives for that which he does." But, he continued, "the press conference, television visibility, lack of follow-through, everything is a civil rights issue paradigm with leadership is profoundly unaccountable to the masses of people and to history." Remarkable words coming from the man who is the son of the guy who practically invented the everything is a civil rights issue campaign. "Don't get him wrong," Jr. continued. "There is a place for the agitation and protest politics of a Jesse Jackson Sr. and an Al Sharpton. But it is not here," he said, "not now." The elder Jackson is keenly aware of his son's apostasy. He said to me, I encourage in our house vigorous debate. And there is no punishment for a different point of view. We have different roles. Jackson Sr. is the agitator. Jackson Jr. is the negotiator. I found this time and time again as I talked to people of different generations, whether it was parents and children, or whether it was simply people who were breaking through when it wasn't yet their turn. Along the way, they discovered they had to come to grips with a different approach. Where their parents had marched in on Washington and sat at lunch counters, their children didn't even know what a lunch counter was. The children took advantage of all the laws their parents got passed. I talked to Vernon Jordan, who is, among other things, one of the great leaders of the movement. He was the head of the Urban League, and he believes he's one of the few civil rights leaders he knows of his generation who wasn't carried out of the job in a box. His words, not mine. He says that there are, let me get to the part. He says that there are five distinct brands of black leadership. The grassroots activist, the corporate titan. Grassroots activists, think Al Sharpton. Corporate titan, think Richard Parsons. The traditional civil rights organizer, think Vernon Jordan, think Julian Bond. The self-made entrepreneur, like Russell Simmons, and the elected official, which, of course, I write about. These leaders range from CEOs to hip-hop artists to mayors, and they do not necessarily represent a single worldview. He said to me, when we went across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which, of course, was in Selma, there was no guarantee we were all going to come out the same on the other side. Clarence Thomas, he said, went across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, too. Now, he's speaking figuratively, of course. But it's an important point, which is that in some level, these black politicians realized on some level that they had a lot in common, but they had a lot different. One case in point might be your own mayor. I talked to Mayor Nutter in preparing for this book, and at the time that we sat down and talked, it was an interesting time. It was the middle, toward the end of the primary process last year. Michael Nutter probably, sealed his reputation as a black maverick the day he decided to endorse a white woman for president. At a time when it looked like a black man might be a serious candidate for the first time, it was a politically courageous feat. Nutter was not shy about his decision, although he was aligned safely in the shadow of one of the state's most powerful politicians, former Philadelphia mayor and now governor Ed Rendell. Nutter broke with much of the city's black establishment when he decided not to back Obama. When Clinton dropped out and Nutter shifted his allegiance to the apparent party nominee, there was nary a ripple. It turned out the people who elected him to do more important things than endorse other politicians were not all that upset with his choice. He said to me, it was kind of like, we really like the job you're doing, kind of disagree with this decision over here, but yeah, that's politics. So you're a politician. You deal with that. Make our streets safe. Do your job. Obama did win the majority of votes in Philadelphia, but Hillary Clinton did better than expected. For that, she would have Michael Nutter to thank. Politicians, of course, always deal in politics. One of Obama's chief backers was Representative Chaka Fateh, who had run against Nutter for the city's top job in 2007 and been endorsed by Obama when he did it. But barely 100 days into his new job, Nutter had more urgent things on his mind than national politics. This, too, was true of Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark. It's one thing to break through. It's another thing to govern. It's a great idea to have this thought that I, in the case of Cory Booker, I'm going to take my Oxford degree and my Stanford degree and my suburban upbringing, and I'm going to save the inner city. I'm going to save Newark. It's another thing to be mayor of Newark and find out that you woke up in the middle of the night, your BlackBerry's going off, and five children were killed execution style on a school playground. That's when he had to deal with the reality of breaking through. The actual idealism that we have, which, by the way, I believe all of this can apply to what we're seeing now in Washington, as opposed to the reality of actually doing the job. One of the most interesting things I came across reporting this book is that I found out how much in common a lot of these breakthrough candidates had, even though they might not necessarily know each other. Some of them knew each other, but not most of them. They were operating on parallel lines. And one of the things I discovered, too, was they all heard the same things as they broke through. One of the things they all heard was this, only from other African Americans. You're not black enough. I heard it so much. I heard it from Barack Obama, of course, heard it quite a bit. I remember him showing up at a black journalist convention in August, a year ago August, and being about 10 minutes late, which was highly unusual for him. And when he arrived on stage, he apologized for being late and said, but I heard y'all think I wasn't black enough. Of course, the white people in the room went, can I laugh at that? Conversations we're having. But everybody said, yes, I was asked this question. I talked to the city council president in Atlanta, an African-American woman who said she was amazed that after she had raised her children, after she had gotten her education, after she spoke the Queen's English, after she had done all these things, that she was standing in a debate, in a citywide debate, and someone asked her that question. She said, what does that mean? Mayor Nutter said the same thing to me. He said, I'm still not exactly sure what that means. Is he black enough? Of course, you would never hear that about a non-African-American or somebody who is white. Oh, he's not white enough. What does that mean? You know what you do hear, though, and this comes exclusively from white people, is he too black? That's the flip side. That's what Barack Obama dealt with when he was trying to figure a way out of the Jeremiah Wright conundrum. The key for all politicians, no matter what their race, is to narrow the chasm of difference between themselves and the people they're asking to vote for them. And to the extent that black voters look at you and say, I don't know if you're on my side, I don't know if you will speak to me, that's where the question, is he black enough, comes from. And to the degree that white voters say, is he on my side, will he speak for me, that's what the question, is he too black, comes from. It's the same place. On the night Barack Obama won the South Carolina primary, his supporters could barely contain themselves. Bouncing back from a surprise defeat 2 weeks before in New Hampshire, the double-digit victory thrilled a multiracial crowd gathered that night in the heart of the South. When their candidate appeared, they took up a chant. Race doesn't matter. Race doesn't matter. They shouted it. The chant built. It spread throughout the room. Now, standing at the foot of the stage in a ballroom just blocks from the state capitol, Obama's pollster, Cornell Belcher, who is African-American, watched this all in astonishment. Here you are, he told me later, in South Carolina, 3 blocks from where the Confederate flag is still flying in front of the state capitol, and all the history that is held in that state. And you have a group of young white people shouting, race doesn't matter. Now, do they think there is no racism? No. But were they screaming and shouting the world they wanted to exist? Yeah, that is powerful and profound and very different. This may have been the only night during the course of the campaign where anyone believed that race indeed did not matter. Certainly the candidate at the center of all the euphoria didn't believe it. Obama, like every other elected official in the United States, was keenly aware of how much the nation's mood swings on race could determine the outcome of a competitive election. Sometimes race hurt, sometimes it helped, but it always mattered. As I've been traveling the country talking about this book, I've been heartened to discover that people are ready for a conversation. Many of you may have heard about the Attorney General's speech last week where he talked about the nation of cowards. There are a couple things with that speech which were provocative, mostly the use of the word coward. Because what he was saying, which got lost in that what felt like a gauntlet thrown down to so many people, what he was saying was that we've forgotten how to, if we ever knew, how to talk to each other across racial lines. We don't socialize together. We don't hang out together, even though this crowd is very encouraging. But one of the smartest commentaries I've heard about that speech pointed out that much of the negative reaction to it was rooted in the idea that Eric Holder was only talking to white people. He was calling black people cowards, too. He was saying we're not having these conversations either way. So what I've discovered as I've traveled the country is that people want to have this conversation. They want to find a way to have it, but they want to talk about race for a change where it's not about guilt and blame and accusation. If we can get to that place, think of what kind of conversation we could actually have. I got an email. I'm going to say tell you this one little story, then I'd love to take your questions because, as I said, that's what's fun for me. When I got an email from a viewer not long ago saying, why is it you always refer to Barack Obama as black? Which I don't do, so I don't know what he was watching. Actually, I have an idea, but anyway. But then he went on to say, and why can't we just forget that he's African American? So that caught my ear, and my question back to this viewer was, why do we want to forget? Do we want to forget it because we think of it as a negative? Do we think of it as a burden? If that's the case, let's have that conversation. Because I personally don't wake up in the morning going, oh, Lord, I'm black again. I was so hoping. What we have to learn to do is embrace each other's difference without being accusatory about it or assuming it's a negative. If we can even begin to have that conversation, that bodes well for all of these breakthrough candidates and for where America goes next. I'll stop there for now and take your questions. There are microphones in the aisles. Thank you. There are these nice people, and they've got microphones. Okay, hi. Which we'll turn on. Try it again.
Okay. Hello. Okay. In your book, in the chapter where you talk about Deval Patrick and his challenges and some of his naivete and not understanding the importance of images and so on, I wondered, because we all know how close he was to the president's campaign, I wonder if you think that that particular type of problem, some of the naivete or the not fully grasping imagery and so on, mm-hmm. could also apply to the president, whether that might actually become a problem for the president or not.
Well, here's the difference, and I'll fill in for those of you who haven't had a chance to read the book, even though I know what you're all doing tonight. Deval Patrick had never run for as much as dog catcher before. He had never been elected to public office. And one of the things about breakthrough candidates is that sometimes it's helpful to have done a thing or two before that had to do with politics in order to understand the things that can trip you up. And so when he got into the governor's office, he discovered that the previous governor, Mitt Romney, had taken everything with him, including the drapes at the windows and the rugs on the floor, because he'd paid for them. He's a rich man. But he left none of this behind. So what did the new governor do was order drapes and rugs for the floor. Well, the drapes cost $60,000. The new car that he ordered was a Cadillac, which, by the way, most of the governors in America had, but for some reason, a black man ordering a Cadillac, they started calling him Coupe Duval in the Boston Herald. His wife thought this was a little vaguely racist. Okay. So there's this. So he gets in and he makes a couple of pretty dumb stumbles. He also makes some substantive stumbles. He doesn't court the legislator the way he ought to. He makes a phone call on behalf of a client he once represented that he shouldn't have made. There are things like this which any politician would have seen was a mistake. He didn't have that kind of background. Now, the connection to Barack Obama is one that which is built largely through a shared political consultants. The same two men who ran Barack Obama's campaign, David Plouffe and David Axelrod, who justifiably deserve a lot of credit for the way this campaign went, also worked for Deval Patrick. And here's an interesting distinction between the two of them, or maybe they're more alike than not. Remember when Barack Obama came to Philadelphia to give the big race speech? He came here only because he had no choice. He did not want to talk about race. He didn't want to mention race in his campaign acceptance speech at Vesco Field in Denver. He didn't mention Martin Luther King by name, even though it was the 45th anniversary of the March on Washington. He, in his biography speech, you saw a lot about Kansas and not a lot about Kenya. This is what he was doing to close the gap that I talked about, the gap of difference, in order to get people who had different backgrounds than he had to vote for him. Deval Patrick wanted to give a race speech, and these same two advisors advised him against it, and he didn't. He didn't because they thought, and maybe they were correct, that he would call attention to the difference, and that's not how you get elected. So But if he had been cornered, if there had been a race, explosively race-driven campaign against him, as there was involving Jeremiah Wright, I think Deval Patrick would have won the day on that argument that he had to speak to this issue. It is an interesting comparison, but I do think that Barack Obama, by having run once and lost against Bobby Rush in Chicago, and having run and then won statewide in Illinois, had a lot more, at least political sense, saying that the most charitable way possible, than Deval Patrick did when he first became governor. Yes, where did the microphones go? Who's got, does somebody have one? She's got her hand up.
Good afternoon, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
To what extent do you feel that Barack Obama's not having had the black experience and the slave background, the fact that he is the son of an African who never experienced slavery in this country or endured any of the things that Jesse Jackson brings to the brings to his politics. How do you think that helped him to become president, or if you feel that it did?
You know, it's hard for me to say. I'm a daughter of a son. There are days, you know. I'm the daughter of West Indian immigrants. And in the African-American community, which is fond of slicing itself up into little chunks and slices, we were considered to be outsiders as well. Now, it should be said that we'd still had the slave experience, it's just sugar cane instead of cotton. But there was lots of question along the way about whether Barack Obama's black experience was truly authentic. I think that was the same question about whether his experience in general was truly authentic. He grew up the son of a peripatetic mother. He was raised by grandparents all over the place. He, however, in the end, and you can see this in his first book, gave a lot more thought to what his identity was and how he would choose to pursue his identity than most of us ever have to. And so, I mean, I just thought that Dreams from My Father was meditative in its tale of someone who was wrestling to decide who he would be. And most of us are just born to it and fall into it. So I give him extra points for having at least given it some thought. If you guys could stand in the middle, that way we don't have to send people. Thanks.
Gwen, last night on your program, and we never miss you, okay?
You.
We love you. The discussion was about how much Barack Obama has on his plate.
Yes, indeed.
And how bold a vision he's bringing. And with your experience, I'd like to have you comment on that, because normally you're asking the questions. You know what I mean?
He's trying to trick me.
No. See, because your book is about political perspective, mm-hmm. and I feel very confident that he's going to achieve a lot, because I thought he was incredible in the whole campaign. But I just wonder what you think.
Yeah, I do think he ran an incredible campaign. There's no question. Nothing succeeds like success. I would never doubt that. I do, however, I've never in my political coverage career ever seen as much on one plate at one time. I mean, what he is asking America to do, which they might be doing. I mean, they might be willing to do this, but he's asking to do a lot. Now, he's a student of history, and he looked at what Bill Clinton did, which is the one-at-a-time campaign, and he said that didn't work because by the time he got around to health care, people were slapping him down because he had stumbled on other things. So he says, okay, we're going to try it all at once. We're going to spend $1 gazillion, and we're going to cut the deficit, okay? And then we're going to fix health care. We're going to fix the economy. We're going to take on entitlements, and the banks are failing. As he said in his interview with Jim Lehrer yesterday, I wish all the planes were in the air at one time. And I had to resist making a Hudson River joke. But because I was raised right, I didn't. I don't know yet whether he can do that. I don't know whether simply getting elected president gives you the skills to pull all of that. I think he's realistic enough, and his people are realistic enough to know all of it's not going to happen. And in fact, there are people in Congress who lose sleep at nights trying to figure out how to make sure all of it's not going to happen. And some of them are Democrats. So, but it won't be for lack of a heroic try. And the other thing you reason is, I'm never going to have 70% approval rating again. So let's just try. Let's go for it.
Many of us were disappointed that you are not the moderator of Meet the Press.
Oh, I didn't know where that was going when she said disappointed. There are so many things.
Were you disappointed?
You know, I think things happen the way they're supposed to. I definitely had a conversation with them about it. But, you know, I think I'm okay where I am. Here's the history of that story. When I was at, I worked for, in newspapers for half of my career. My last newspaper job was at the New York Times, covering the White House, which I got to make occasional appearances not only on Washington Week, but also on Meet the Press. My buddy Tim Russert dared me to come into television full time. He basically not only dared me, but then in the true sense of a real mentor and friend, made sure I succeeded. Gave me the support I needed, taught me how to do television. He drew the line at telling me what to do about my hair. Which was good. But he created an environment which allowed me to succeed, which is all you can ask of a mentor. So I have an incredible well of emotional loss about the loss of Tim Russert. I still wish I could hear his voice every day about this election. So when his job, you know, when they started talking about his job and talking to me about it, I obviously considered it. But you know what? I honestly think things happen the way they're supposed to, and I feel like I'm in the right place. I feel like you don't get many platforms like I have to tell the story, to investigate the story Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays on the NewsHour, and then go on Friday night and play with my friends in my sandbox on Washington Week. It's a great spot to be, and I'm happy to be there. Really am. Let's go to this side. Okay.
I've been a big fan of yours since you wrote for the New York Times. I'm also a big fan of Doris Kearns Goodwin, and I'm imagining a conversation that you may have had with her regarding breakthroughs, because Doris Kearns Goodwin, as we all know, is a big Brooklyn Dodger fan. And the breakthrough I'm thinking about is Jackie Robinson. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had that conversation with her?
I have not had that conversation with her, but now you just – I think I'm calling her for lunch. I really would like to have that conversation with her. Thank you for asking. Putting that idea in my head. Let's get somebody inside a little bit because she's a little bit off the aisle.
I'm sure.
We'll get to you.
Hi, thank you so much. I had two questions. First of all, have you given any particular thought to the emergence of female black politicians in the larger political sphere in the United States, since it sounds like your book has focused on males? And secondly, have you met Queen Latifah?
What was the second question?
Have you met Queen Latifah?
I have.
Very cool.
Okay, I'm going to answer the fun question first. Queen Latifah also played me in the Saturday Night Live debate parody 4 years ago. 4 years ago she did it, and it was great fun. She dressed just like me, looked just like me. It was very cool, but people didn't pay the same attention as they did this time. So I see her, I meet her in Washington at a screening for The Secret Life of Bees, which is a fabulous movie, which you used to rent if you didn't see it. And she and I was... you know, flush. And I went over and wangled an introduction. And she said, of course I know who you are. And I said, oh, really? And then I said, this was before I knew I was doing the vice presidential debate this year. And I said, gee, I really would like for you to play me again. She said, well, give me some material. So it was very exciting. And I was, you can imagine, they kept replaying it because Tina Fey was so fabulous and so was Queen. And then here's the other story. After I broke my ankle, I had to come back after the debate, which, by the way, I was on no drugs. I was perfectly fine. They brought me out on stage on crutches with these two football players from the university named Tim and Buck. It was the high point of the evening. But when I came back to Washington, I had to have surgery on my ankle. And that night, I was on drugs, but there were witnesses. My phone rang, and it was Queen Latifah calling to make sure I was okay. Now, the second question, which is actually more serious, because I did sit down here at the beginning and think, oh, my God, I haven't found any black women to profile. And so I went on a hunt. I went searching high and low for black women who would fit this general idea about what a breakthrough candidate was. And I had more trouble than I anticipated. I did come across the district attorney of San Francisco, Kamala Harris, who since the book came out has announced that she's running for attorney general of the state of California, which is be quite a breakthrough. I did talk to the city council president in Atlanta. I did talk to a state senator in Massachusetts who has since been indicted, so she's breaking through in the wrong way. mayor of Baltimore, same kind of thing. But anyway, but I've talked to a lot of people. But what I discovered was that there were not that many women of a certain age, which is to say, Nancy Pelosi only became Speaker of the House when she was a grandmother. Shirley Franklin, the mayor of Atlanta, who I also talked to, was in her 60s when she got elected mayor. When I asked her why she hadn't run sooner, because she'd been the right hand for at least two previous mayors of Atlanta, her answer was, oh, I don't know, I didn't think I could do it. Now, this is an incredibly accomplished woman who was waiting to be asked, which is true of so many women, and that is only multiplied with African-American women. I talked to women who are involved in recruiting women for office and said, where are these women? Why aren't they there? And they told me part of it was waiting to be asked. Part of it is not having the nerve to just walk up and ask for money. But a huge part of it is women who are raising their families first. And if they choose public service, they often choose public service in other ways that don't involve elective office, like running nonprofits, which there's a disproportionate number probably of women in these are still leadership public service positions. So I rested comfortably at the end of the day that I had made a thorough search, but not comfortably that the answer is there yet or the breakthrough is quite at the cusp that it could be yet with African American women. Right on the aisle there. Yeah.
I have a quick question. Back to your show last night, there was a lot of comment about the amount of self-confidence that Obama has. Like, I have forgotten exactly what they said, but it was like a surfeit of self-confidence. And I'm wondering if you could address that.
Yeah, that could easily be taken for being cocky and arrogant, couldn't it? But actually, it's not. He is an incredibly self-inner-directed person. You can tell it from the way he walks, the way he talks, the way he really doesn't put up with a lot of nonsense. He's fairly certain he's the smartest guy in the room at all times. Often is. The reason why it's worth commenting on is at a time when Americans are scared and feeling a little shaky and unsure, it is not to be underestimated what a lot of self-confidence can do in your leaders. The last thing you want to see when you're feeling unsure about the next step is to see the guy in front of you losing his footing on the mountain. So he's playing to that. He is very clear, at least he believes clearly that that's what people want from him. And it happens to segue very much with his own certainty. We'll be tracking that as time goes along, because there are a whole lot of people, as I suggested, who are poised to take him down a peg, politically, I mean. And I find it also interesting that we have not seen, in a political sense, an African-American leader with that certain kind of confidence where he wasn't called uppity. So we're going to see how long that is considered to be a good thing. Can you go all the way to the back, the woman in the green scarf?
Thank you. Hi, Ms. Eiffel. Good to meet you. My question is, in the book you talked about some former leaders who were willing to pass the baton and some who weren't. The leaders that come up after the Cory Bookers and the Patrick DeVals now, how can they strike a balance between showing respect for the older ones who kicked the doors down but moving on? How can they strike a balance?
It's a tough one, because once you get in there, it feels good to you, and it's hard to naturally turn it over. I was talking to the Speaker of the California Assembly is a woman named Karen Bass. She has just become the Speaker last year, and she's going to be term-limited, so she won't be there very long. She came there from L.A., and she had created her own community service organization. And she does not plan to return to the organization because she feels strongly she should pass the baton on to someone else to run it. So there is a rare example along the way, interesting that it's a woman, of someone who decides to give up power and not try to hold on to it. Now, maybe there are other things she'll run for instead. It is a dilemma in many respects, how you know when it is to step aside. Benjamin Jealous, who's the new head of the NAACP, is 35 years old. He told me that he told a story where he marched as a much younger activist in the 1993 March on Washington for Jobs, Justice, and Peace. And there was some unhappiness because the people on the main iconic stage, the Lincoln Memorial stage, were the old lions of the movement, and they were holding forth. And all the young people, it felt, had been shunted over to the Washington Monument stage, or the kiddie stage, as they called it, where they didn't get the same attention. And he complained. He remembers complaining about this to Julian Bond, whose response to him was, if I have power that you perceive you want, it is your job to snatch it. And so that's the other thing these breakthrough candidates are doing. They're snatching it. Waiting for someone to say, okay, your turn, doesn't work. Yes. Here, wait till the mic arrives.
Thank you for your book. It was very enlightening. I have a couple of questions. They're related to the point we just made. What do you think is the future of the Congressional Black Caucus? One. And two, in the midst of the IMAS debacle and the recent campaign, what do you think about the rise of the young black journalists who have suddenly materialized and appeared on network TV and cable and news, et cetera?
Well, you sure asked the hard ones. The first question, the future of the Congressional Black Caucus is an interesting one because one of the things that built the numbers of the Congressional Black Caucus was the way that districts were carved out in order to favor black neighborhoods, black communities, so that they would be more likely to send black folks to Congress. Julius Chambers, who was the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, told me when I talked to him for this book that maybe now with the success of the Corys and the Obamas, as he put it, you have to rethink that approach. So there's some question about whether the Congressional Black Caucus, I don't think it's going anywhere, by the way, but whether it's going to become a different kind of organization or not. For instance, when Harold Ford stepped down in order to run for Senate in Tennessee, the person who was elected to his seat, which was a black district in Memphis, was a white Jewish man, Stephen Cohen. And even though he's twice had to stand for that seat and been challenged by black elected officials, he's always won it back again. But they won't let him in the Congressional Black Caucus, even though he represents black people. So at what point do you have to rethink what the purpose of the caucus is? The second question, and is there anybody here who does not know what the IMAS debacle was, which I was unfortunately tangentially involved in, was when he decided to go on the radio and called the Rutgers basketball players ugly names. My tangential involvement was I wrote an article for the New York Times opinion page saying stop it, essentially. Pick on people your own size, which he picked on me, and that was fine, but picking on them was not permissible. So he lost his job. He's got his job back. He's fine. Whatever. But I don't – what was the end of the question? Oh, yeah. You know what? There are new faces, but they're not by and large. And I have a pretty rigid definition of what a journalist is. There are a lot of people talking. And some of them are black and some of them are white and but you know what? They really aren't. Journalists to me are people who go out and actually are giving you information that they have reported and it's based on actual knowledge as opposed to opinion. Now, there are opinion journalists and that's where it all gets blurry for people. Bob Herbert, who writes for the New York Times, is an opinion journalist. Janelle Armstrong, I guess, still writes for the Philadelphia, but she's an opinion journalist. I got no problem calling them journalists, but there are a whole lot of people who are just pundits. They just pop off whatever's on their mind that day. Whatever they read last on a blog, they become a journalist. So don't be fooled that there is suddenly this new influx of black journalists covering this administration or covering it just because he's black. It ain't true. There are not that many of us still, and it is one of my, as you can tell from the sudden turn in my tone of voice, it is one of my pet peeves. And if I were to step aside tomorrow from the job I do and I didn't feel there were other people doing this, I would be a failure. Let's go to this side. Right there, back where you are. There's a guy in the back.
I wanted to know what you thought about Michael Steele with the Republicans and the reasons why.
What is all this laughter, people? Let him finish the question.
And... I mean, and what you think his how he's going to climb or what's going to happen with him in connection with the kind of people you talk about in your book. Also, Bobby Jindal.
Okay, let's back up. Michael Steele, I talked to him for the book. And he used to be Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, and he's now, of course, now the new head of the Republican National Committee. There are those cynics out there who believe he was selected because he's black and Barack Obama's black. I think that's too simplistic. I think he actually found a way to work the system, to collect the votes, and to find a way to speak to a party that was demoralized after this last election, and to find a way to speak to and for them. He's been doing this not as head of the RNC, but as, I mean, he was one of the few speakers at the Republican National Convention. He was the one who coined the term drill baby drill. And it wasn't her, it was him, actually. And he, and the interesting thing about Michael Steele is he found a way to speak to the disaffected in his own party who were not happy with the previous 8 years. And that's the platform he's building for himself. He, when I talked to him for this book, was, by the way, 2% of the delegates at the Republican National Convention were African American. It was so bad that if I walked across the floor, somebody black would come up and hug me thinking I was another delegate. And imagine their surprise when they found out I was the evil media. But what he said to me at the time, the word he used was that he said to me, it's embarrassing. He said, it's embarrassing. He believed then and presumably believes now that the party, in order to grow, needs to find a way, and this explains the part of the Bobby Jindal issue, it needs to find a way to look more like America's going to look tomorrow than like it looked yesterday. There was a time when the Republican Party completely got this, a recent time. Ken Melman, who was George W. Bush's first RNC chairman, he was completely committed to this idea of expanding the tent. Karl Rove was. George W. Bush trying to force his party's hand on immigration reform, believed that getting Latino voters was a way to expand the party. This was either rejected or set aside or ignored. And so now they're at this position where they have to find a way to rebuild from the ground up. Now they have some significant issues. For instance, this week at the Conservative Political Action Conference, Michael Steele was introduced by a young blonde congresswoman who, after he spoke, responded by saying, "You the man. You be the man." Now, I haven't seen the tape of it, and I'm going to go look, because I want to see the look on Michael Steele's face when she did this. If he was smiling and laughing, I'm troubled. But I don't think that the survival of the Republican Party, and there are people within the party who I have talked to who are engaged in outreach, they know that the survival of the party is finding a way to expand its base. Yes.
In your travels and in your interviews, in your book, you mention Obama speaking about it's not a white America, not a black America, not a Latino or Asian America, but the United States of America. And having lived through the Martin Luther King age, where I was reared in Birmingham, Alabama, and had to go to a fountain that said colored and sat at a counter being spit on. And then working with the national race reconciliation, honest conversation movement. Do you see a breakthrough for fresh thinking as Obama has, that there is a United States of America, and that even though there was this sea of people, and these people, as McCain said, America has spoken when they elected him, yet when he put forth the agenda, it's not sanctioned as if the people, he's speaking for the people. So do you see a breakthrough in the arena with this race?
I don't know. I think we have to not hang all this on one black president. I was doing some research recently and came across the speech that Barbara Jordan gave to the 1976 Democratic National Convention. If you have a chance to reread it, you'll discover that she echoes a lot of the things that he said in 2004 about unity, about reaching across lines. This was not a brand new idea. But what it is an idea in which we are building and hopefully building on, in which we're opening ourselves to conversations, and where we don't take one setback like a silly cartoon about a chimp as evidence that there's no way to break through to the next level. It has to be something that is a continuum. We were having this discussion the other morning at the NewsHour. We were thinking, should we do a big discussion about race in America? And frankly, I wasn't that much in love with the idea, because then you do that and we feel we've done it. Whereas it ought to be something we're talking about, dipping into differently over time. We're on this side. Can we go to the woman way back in the corner here who might otherwise be overlooked? Hi.
Thank you for being here. You're in our living room every Friday evening, and I wish I could have you to supper. But
me too, I think.
Yeah.
Are you a good cook?
Well, you are there for supper every Friday night.
But I just don't know it.
Yeah, you just don't know it. What I do in my life is that I'm a healthcare chaplain. And one of the things I love about it, especially being in this city, is that in the trauma bay or at the bedside when someone is dying, when there's great suffering, racial and religious boundaries start to matter a lot less.
Yeah.
So I can be very comfortable in black neighborhoods and houses, and you know, and other people I think can be much more comfortable with me across the racial boundary. I wonder if there isn't a parallel in that to the situation we're in as a nation now, with the crises and the pain of the economy and
that basically
healthcare.
When we're ready to die, we're ready to talk to each
yeah.
other.
Well, yeah, I wonder, really. You know, maybe, you know, we're in a trauma bay and
yeah,
Obama
maybe.
Can be there. Yeah, so.
No, but, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make fun of your question. I see what you're saying, which is it provides stress, provides an opportunity for us to suddenly see what we have in common rather than what our differences are.
Right, yeah. Would you talk a little bit about your own breakthrough as a black woman journalist?
You know, it's funny. I don't think of myself as a breakthrough, even though I suppose in many respects I am. I got my first job in journalism right out of college. I was doing an internship at the Boston Herald American. As I mentioned, Boston was not exactly rife with racial sensitivity at the time. And I was the first kind of thing most of my colleagues had ever seen, an educated black woman. They didn't know what to make of me. But I didn't seem to bite, and I seemed to be cheerfully go and get their coffee, so we got along fine. But when I was done with my internship that summer, I was working in the photo department. I remember going to work one day to my little workspace and finding a little note attached to the space that said, "Nigger, go home." Now, it should be said that I wondered who this was for. Because I wasn't raised to think, you know. So I looked at it and I took it innocently, actually not so innocently as you might think, to my boss and said, "Gee, look at this." And he was horrified and his boss was horrified and yada yada. It went up the line till they said if you ever, basically they knew the guy who'd written it. He was close to retirement. They didn't want to fire him. It wasn't going to serve me any purpose for him to be fired. So when they said, "Well, if you ever need a job, come back and knock on our door." And of course, you know, 20-year-old, "I will never work for those racists," I said. At 21, when I didn't have a job, I thought, well, maybe this seemed like a pretty good offer. So I went back and I got that job and I learned a couple of valuable lessons, which is just because you get in the door doesn't mean that you can stay there. You'll be the first one kicked out if you don't do your job. So I got in there and I used that as my way in and I used it as a way to start writing. And my first chance to write was to write about, the first writing job open was to write about food. Now I could not cook, but I learned. I learned how to write about food without poisoning our readers. I learned how to learn brand new things every day, which is what I do for my job now. If there's a coup in Macedonia tomorrow, I'm going to have to figure out where is Macedonia. And it's a great thing to go to work every day and have brand new things that you learn. And by being open to possibilities and to learning new things along the way, I think I was put in a position. And by the way, and I say this to all the young people I talk to, and also pursuing excellence in every case and not assuming just because you're there, that's enough. That's the secret to breaking through for me. Okay.
The question is, and it may be very simplistic, how do journalists see their role? Is it to inform the audience or to form the audience?
That's not simplistic at all. That's a smart question. And you know it. He's a preacher. He's trying to be sneaky. It is to inform. My job is to inform. If I were an opinion journalist, it would be to change your mind. I feel very strongly that my job is to give you all the information you can stand and then let you make up your own mind. That is not the worldview of a lot of opinion journalists, and neither does it have to be. But it is also not the worldview of a lot of kind of raucous, more heat than light cable television debate. I have such amazing faith in people who watch me on television or read what I write to make up their own minds about things. And here's a great example. Just before this, when this book was still in process and just before that debate and everybody was raising questions about whether I could do it fairly or not, I knew an important thing which my detractors didn't know, which is that the audience is pretty smart. In 2004, when I moderated the Cheney-Edwards debate, I asked each of them a question about the incidence of AIDS among African-American women in America. And I preceded it by saying, I don't want you to talk about Africa this time. I want you to talk about the incidence of HIV infection close to home. And I cited the numbers and the statistics. And their reactions were essentially, Edwards started talking about Africa. He didn't hear what I'd said at all because someone had told him I was going to ask about Africa. So that's what he answered. And Cheney said, really? I could have, at that moment, pounded on the podium and said, how dare you? You didn't hear my question. But I didn't, because I assumed, and correctly as it turned out, that people at home went, huh, they didn't know the answers to those questions. This is not a subject they value. And my work was done. Now, 4 years later, fast forward to this last debate, where you all are so bad. Where at one key point early on, the vice presidential, Republican vice presidential candidate said to me that she did not feel the need to answer my questions. I could have then said, answer my questions, you agreed to the rules. Or I could have done what I did, was say, and go on. Now, there's a school of thought that I should have chased her around the table and beat her up. My school of thought, what I had learned from having done this before, is that people at home would get that she was not playing by her own rules, and I didn't have to drive the point home. So my worldview is that I inform and let you make up your own mind, and that's all I can really speak to. Two more questions. They better be good ones. Okay.
Thank you. We watch your show every week.
Thank you.
To kind of build on that last topic of the vice presidential debate, race and politics, and your personal experience, I'm guessing, to have this question of your impartiality as the moderator questioned based on your race and what your experience in that.
Oh, don't all leave now. Come on now.
Yeah, what was your experience?
Necessarily think it was only race, even though race may have played a role when they're questioning me, because if it had been a white moderator, maybe they would have been less likely to assume bias. But I think it was more about getting inside my head and trying to rattle me, so no matter what I was, and they would use whatever was handy. That's really what I thought it was, and they didn't know about me. Final question right here. Oh, sorry.
Speaking of breakthroughs, what do you think of all the obsession with Michelle Obama's arms? I mean, I really am annoyed.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know. I'm you know.
I'm kind of obsessed myself.
Oh. No, but as a first lady.
No, I've gotten a lot of questions from people who've asked me about Michelle Obama's role in general, and I'll get to the arms in a minute. But I do think that people are still trying to figure out who she is. They're trying to figure out what kind of first lady she's going to be, if she's going to be non-traditional. And we're just latching onto whatever we know. There's immense curiosity about her right now. One of the things I know about Michelle Obama is that during the election, when she dared to speak her mind, when people were paying attention, she was immediately deemed an angry black woman. And so she's smart enough, and she's pretty smart, that she figured out, how do I walk this tightrope? What should my role be? And she's searching for it. She's on a hunt for that. Now, absent her deciding what that is, and there's no reason she has to for now, she's trying to adjust to getting her kids into this completely new environment, we are fixated on her fashion, completely fixated. I mean, I have to admit, I have my shallow sides. And there have been emails, which you could find in the archives in my email box, which have to do with her hair. And she does make me want to go to the gym, doggone it. But I also have heard her speak in a way which I think might speak to some of this, which is she has, early on when no one was really paying attention to what she was saying, she was giving speeches speaking to women about taking care of themselves and speaking to the degree to which women not only are so busy taking care of others, but they're spending very little attention on exercise, on eating correctly. She is completely obsessed herself about that issue. So to the extent that she can herself be a walking, talking example of the way we ought to be balancing our lives, I think that she wants to be that. But I'm certain that's not all she wants to be, and she's going to take her time to figure that out. But she looks good, though. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.